Before we start, just a warning that this episode contains details of graphic violence. On June 23rd, 2020, Ahmed Harakat woke up in his home in the Palestinian town of Abu Dis. It was his sister's wedding day, and just weeks before his own wedding. That day, Ahmed left his house to run errands for the family. It would be the last time they'd see him. Just before 4 p.m., his car crashed into a checkpoint. And minutes later, Israeli border police officers shot him dead. I'm Henriette Shakar, and you're listening to the 972 podcast. In this episode, we're going to unpack the killing of Ahmed Harakat and focus on a new investigation that casts doubt on the Israeli authorities' account. Here's what we know about Ahmed. He was 27 years old. He ran a print shop, making advertising materials and decals for local businesses. Most of his social media posts are photos and videos he's taken with friends, like this one, where they're celebrating a friend's graduation. There are videos of him smoking shisha, playing pool, and cheering at a local soccer game. He's also gone live on Facebook a few times, seemingly when nothing particularly exciting is happening, like while selling SIM cards at a booth in Jericho. We also know Ahmed was engaged.
He was preparing for his wedding.
This is Faisal, Ahmed's eldest brother.
His house was ready, with furniture, with everything.
He describes Ahmed as a young man who was looking forward to the future. The family lives in Abu Dis, population 13,000. It's a Palestinian town just east of Jerusalem.
It's a part of Jerusalem. From my roof, I can see the tomb of rock, and Aqsa Mosque from my roof. It's very clear.
Israel occupied the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem in 1967. Since then, it has confiscated Abu Dis's lands to expand its settlement enterprise and construct bypass roads for Israeli citizens only. After the Second Intifada in the early 2000s, when Ahmed was around 10 years old, Israel built a concrete wall that now segregates the town's residents from Jerusalem.
The segregation wall, it's only away from my house, almost, to be honest with you, less than 20 meters. And you say, I don't know who gave them the right to build that wall and to forbid us, to forbid me and forbid my people and my family to visit our cousins on the other side of that wall and visit you and visit Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Faisal told me that when he was a kid, before the wall was there, he used to be able to walk to his school in Jerusalem. Now, not only is that impossible, but the wall and the Israeli army's checkpoints mean that Palestinians must often travel for longer, whether to visit family and friends, or tend to their agricultural lands beyond the wall, or just get to their workplaces.
So they want to steal our time. This is a new strategy, what they are implementing here. They're stealing our time by making a checkpoint and stopping every car, each car. For example, when I went to go to my work, it takes me 20 minutes. But because of the occupation, when they put this checkpoint, it will take me maybe 1 hour sometimes.
That day, Faisal left work early to get ready for his sister's wedding.
I came back from my work early, and I started getting ready to go to my father's house to receive the people who is coming to take my, this is our traditional, they will come before the wedding, 1 hour before the wedding, and they will take my sister.
That tradition Faisal is talking about is called Tal'at al-Arus. It's a very emotional part of any Arab wedding, symbolizing the bride's farewell to her family as she sets to begin life with her groom. But when Faisal arrived to his parents' house, something felt wrong.
You know, when I arrived my father's house, I saw many people many people is standing there. I was asking the people, what's going on? No one answered me. Then I felt there is something wrong. And to be honest with you, I can't remember what's happened with me that time. I start driving like crazy. I don't know where I went that day. And it was, you know, it was very bad day. It was very bad news. And it was like shock on all our families, members.
So this is how you found out about that Ahmed was shot when you arrived to your father's house?
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, from the news reports I read, it says Ahmed was driving from Abu Dis to pick up your mom and your sister from the hair salon in Bethlehem.
No. He wasn't going there to pick up my mother and my sister. Ahmed, even in my wedding, he used to go to Bethlehem to, you know, decorate his car and to put, you know, I don't know what we call it in English, to put the flowers and the things on the car. From Bethlehem, he has some friends there, and he used to go to them before the wedding every time. My sister, first sister, who got married, he went to Bethlehem. He decorated his car, and me, even my wedding too. So I think that was the reason why he went to Bethlehem that day.
Ahmed was driving from Abu Dis to Bethlehem. Under the 1990s Oslo Accords, these two areas are supposed to be fully governed by the Palestinian Authority. But Israel has placed a checkpoint along the way, known as the Container Checkpoint. It's one of dozens that are spread across the occupied Palestinian territories. Typically, once a driver arrives at a checkpoint, a security officer signals the car to stop. Sometimes it's soldiers, other times it's border police officers, and in some cases it might even be private security guards. They ask to see your identification card. Now, Palestinians can only travel to and from certain areas if they carry a travel permit issued by the Israeli army. Once you're stopped, they might ask you a few questions like, where did you just come from and where are you headed to? Sometimes, they'll ask passengers to get out of the car entirely to conduct a full search. Checkpoints are a huge inconvenience. They're also sites of daily humiliation and violence. In most cases, it's not the life-threatening kind of violence. But that afternoon, Ahmed didn't make it out of the checkpoint alive. As he was approaching the officer's booth, his car swerved into the checkpoint, and he was shot 6 times in 2 seconds. Within minutes of Ahmed getting shot, Israeli authorities categorized the crash as a deliberate act of terrorism. They claimed that when Ahmed got out of the car, moments after the crash, he began charging at the border police officers. They also said that he was examined by medics minutes after getting shot, and that he was found without a pulse. 8 months after the crash, Israeli authorities are still doubling down on their claim that Ahmed had deliberately rammed his car into the checkpoint, even though there still hasn't been an official investigation. To support this version of events, they point to another video that surfaced shortly after the incident. In it, Ahmed looks distressed, and he's rambling about not being a spy. Basically, the authorities are saying that Ahmed planned this attack in a desperate attempt to prove that he wasn't acting as an informant, that he wasn't collaborating with the Israeli army. But if you ask Ahmed's family what happened that day, what mood Ahmed was in, or what he might have been thinking in that moment, they are certain, without a doubt, that this was an accident, a human error.
I don't believe that Ahmed, he was thinking to attack the Israeli soldiers that day, because Ahmed is not stupid. It was his sister's wedding day, you know, and he will never do it. But I don't know what's happened. He lost the control on his car or what's happened.
In an attempt to understand what actually happened at the checkpoint that June afternoon, Ahmed's family turned to forensic architecture.
My name is Christina Barvia.
Christina is the former deputy director at Forensic Architecture. She's now a research fellow at the organization while she pursues her PhD. What is forensic architecture?
Forensic architecture is two things. It's a research agency based at Goldsmiths University of London, and it's also a kind of disciplinary field.
The agency is made up of a diverse team, including researchers, architects, artists, lawyers, activists, and programmers that use spatial and media tools to investigate cases of human rights and environmental violations. They've taken on cases from Israel-Palestine to Hong Kong to Mexico and presented their findings in both national and international courts, and even at the United Nations. What is forensic architecture trying to accomplish? How does the agency view its work?
We are interested to see the way that new technologies change the rules of conversation in the relationship that governments have with their civil society. We're demonstrating our ability to look back and to be able to say, whatever you're doing, we see you.
It sounds like you're trying to big brother the big brother.
Well, we're trying to look back, for sure.
So far, Israel's border police has released only one video of the incident. It's a shaky, grainy phone recording of a laptop screen showing a few seconds of the security camera footage. That video is at the core of the forensic architecture investigation.
It was from that single video, along with the different layers of witness testimonies, 3D modeling, shadow analysis, time synchronization, open source investigation, that we were able to piece together the events of that day.
This is Forensic Architecture's lead researcher on the case.
What became very clear from analyzing this footage was the range of contradictory statements released by the army that day. And we're not just talking about statements that are doubtful, statements that are just plainly incorrect.
She asked to go by a pseudonym for fear of reprisal. So in this episode, I'll be referring to her as Shadi.
I have worked in the region for 18 years and travel a lot. And so it's not very safe for me to identify myself because of all of the border restrictions that come with both my nationality and the type of human rights-oriented work that I do.
Let's unpack the methodologies Shadi mentions. If the Israeli authorities released only a few seconds of footage caught by a single security camera, where did the other evidence come from?
So the moment Ahmed was shot and he was laying there, all the vehicles in the area were instructed to leave by the Israeli authorities. And so some of the most important footage that we have is taken by Palestinian drivers who pull out their phones, you know, these citizen journalists, citizen activists, who film Ahmed as he's lying there, as he's moving, those last moments, his final breaths, who identify the time. The most important video, for example, that we have says it's 3:53. A martyr was just shot. So we use that timestamp supported with our shadow analysis to determine that just a few moments before Ahmed was shot, because we don't actually have the time that he was that the incident actually occurred. That information has not been provided by the army.
When Shadi says the timestamp is supported by shadow analysis, she means her team literally studied the shadows in the images they've gathered to determine the time of day and how much time was passing between each development. The team also collected materials captured by journalists that day. And since the investigation was happening during the coronavirus pandemic, Forensic Architecture couldn't send its own researchers to the field, so they partnered with Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights organization based in Ramallah, to collect testimonies from witnesses. And using satellite images and the topography of the site, they built a 3D model of the checkpoint.
And what this 3D model allowed us to do was to place the events as documented in the video that the Israeli army released in relation to other footage that was collected from the site.
It's basically like putting together a puzzle, where the different pieces fit together. A clearer picture is revealed. And as this larger image comes together, the parts that are still missing also become clearer. With this 3D model, forensic architecture looked into four areas of investigation. The car's behavior, the use of lethal force by the border police officers, whether Ahmed received medical care, and how the Israeli authorities handled Ahmed's body at the scene. Let's take it one frame at a time. Just before 4 p.m., Ahmed arrives at the container checkpoint. The checkpoint has multiple lanes for the cars to come through, and the lanes are separated by concrete dividers. In the lane Ahmed's in, there seem to be three soldiers standing behind a booth. One soldier signals him to stop. This is the soldier, later reflecting on the incident. In the video released by Border Police, we see Ahmed's car first veering to the left, away from the soldiers, and slightly touching the divider. The car then swerves sharply toward the soldiers, and even appears to be accelerating.
When we saw the video as well, to us it looked like the car was accelerating. What we realized when we placed this video in our 3D model of the site was that the car is actually driving downhill. And the only reason it appears that he is accelerating or speeding significantly is because of the perspective. The camera angle that footage is filmed from hides the fact that there's a 3-degree slope. So the car is actually driving downhill. And so it looks like he's accelerating, but in fact, he's not. In fact, it was going at a constant speed of 15 kilometers per hour. So even at the moment of impact, it was going at the same speed as when it started.
The team had their findings peer-reviewed by Dr. Jeremy Bauer, a forensic collision expert. According to Dr. Bauer, the growing distance between the left back wheel and the body of the car, shortly before the car hits the booth, could indicate that Ahmed was actually trying to slow down, to hit the brake.
We would know whether Ahmed was actually hit the brake. We would know whether what the intentions of the driver was and what the instructions of the vehicle was if the army had looked at the black box of Ahmed's vehicle. And we know for a fact that a 2016 Honda Accord, which is the vehicle that Ahmed had rented that morning on the day of his sister's wedding, we know that this vehicle has a black box.
Do you mind explaining what a car's black box is?
The black box is a sort of a memory device that exists in these types of sort of machines that documents the instructions given to the machine, that documents the sort of the responses of that machine. So it will tell you the time when gas was pushed, the amount of gas. It'll tell you the time when a brake was pushed. So it basically is the memory box of communication between the driver and the vehicle or plane. And it's used in investigations around when it comes to plane crashes and car crashes to fill in a lot of the gaps that investigators are looking for.
When the car crashes into the booth, it hits one of the soldiers and knocks her backward. Then we see Ahmed open the door, step out of his car, and walk away from the soldiers. We see him putting his hands up. It's while he's moving backward that Ahmed is shot.
We slowed down the footage, took it frame by frame at each moment of shooting, and we counted around 6 shots fired at Ahmed, one of which we are quite certain hit him in the chest or abdomen area. And this occurred during a time when he opens the door, steps out, first begins to raise his hands, showing clearly that he's unarmed. He then begins to move backwards, is shot again. By the third shot, he is already falling to the ground. Then we have a fourth, a fifth, and a sixth shot where he's already falling to the ground. And at this point, he is 4 meters from the nearest Israeli soldier.
Stretch out both your arms. Now, imagine 4 times this distance. That's roughly 4 meters.
So he is not only unarmed, not causing any immediate or direct threat, but he's far enough for them to understand this fact that he is unarmed. And yet he was shot 6 times within 2 seconds.
In the video released and the main video you rely on in the investigation, we don't actually hear gunshots. How are you able to determine who was shooting and how many times?
The video that was released by the army, first we started to clean it up, which means we stabilized it. We sort of removed the shakiness that comes with any handheld footage. And from there, we changed the contrast of the colors. So it became more of a black and white contrast, which allowed us to read and examine the different shadows that were present. So whenever a bullet was shot, there was sort of a wave or a flush of dust that was emitted. And we counted those rays of dust against the glass of the vehicle. So for against the front glass of the vehicle and against the glass on the window of Ahmed's car.
After the last shot is fired, Ahmed is seen lying on the ground, sort of in a fetal position, bleeding. In one of the bystander videos, he's seen moving, presumably still alive.
Palestinian drivers around him are documenting him still moving, he's still alive, as Israeli soldiers walk by him, indicating to each other that the scene is clear. None of them approach him or touch him.
Soon after, an Israeli ambulance arrives. It leaves about 45 minutes later, carrying only the soldier who was lightly injured. Meanwhile, Ahmed is still lying in the same position.
We modeled the site, we modeled Ahmed's body, and what we realized was that his body was in the exact same position after he was shot as when the Israeli ambulance service left, which means that there was no significant medical care or assistance or attention provided to him because his body simply was not moved.
A Palestinian ambulance also arrives at the scene, but the Israeli authorities stop it at the outer gate and deny it entry. Even though the Israeli authorities haven't issued an investigation into Ahmed's killing, one way that they're confirming their version of events is by using this video that surfaced after the killing. In the video, Ahmed is seen rambling and saying that he's not a spy. Is that something that you looked into?
So we did watch those videos. There are 2 of them that we saw. Ahmed is wearing the same color shirt as he was that day. The color of the car that he was driving appears to match the one he was driving that day. So there are indications that those videos were taken on the same day, although that's something that the family says is not the case, and friends of Ahmed have said is not the case, that these are old videos. We did understand from the video that he was distressed. He was calm, but he was distressed, talking about rumors against him and his family being collaborators, which were clearly upsetting to him. But that was not part of our investigation. Our investigation was to look at the footage and that the army released and to understand what that reveals. And frankly, the focus on these videos is a distraction from our findings, which shows that there are major holes in the army's claims, that he was unarmed, the car did not accelerate, he was denied medical care, he was not running towards the military. I mean, these are the key findings that need to be addressed in the press, that the army needs to account for. And so repeated reference to those videos and what they could have meant is in the end a way to kind of diverge or distract or dilute the findings. Furthermore, anyone who knows even the basic details of this military occupation knows how much daily humiliation and frustration Palestinians go through. And so Palestinians are allowed to be distressed. They're allowed to be traumatized. They're allowed to be stressed. One does not lead to the other. There's no implication that him feeling like this would have meant that something like this was intentional. But as I said, that was outside of the purview of our investigation.
Ahmed Arakat was killed days after another incident of police brutality.
Investigators told the family of an autistic Palestinian man from East Jerusalem who was shot dead by Israeli police that security cameras in Jerusalem's old city were not recording at the time of the shooting.
Iyad al-Hallak, a Palestinian man with autism, was shot dead also by Israeli border police. He was walking from his home in Jerusalem to his special needs school, the way he had been for years. The officer said they suspected Iyad was holding a suspicious object that looked like a pistol. He wasn't. Iyad's killing sparked protests across Israel-Palestine. This was also the summer that U.S. police choked George Floyd to death.
Where, as you know, chaos and anger have erupted across the country over the death of George Floyd. He's the black.
And activists were drawing comparisons between the killing of black people and Palestinians at the hands of law enforcement. Shadi says that this was partly why forensic architecture took Ahmed's case.
Ahmed was shot on the 23rd of June. That was during a time when the whole world was immersed in black-led protests against police violence and hyper-militarization of policing around the world. And when I saw Ahmed, I also saw Michael Brown, you know, laying there, being denied medical care, denied access to his family, bleeding to death in those final moments.
It's also why the agency asked Dr. Angela Davis, a radical black activist and scholar, to do the voiceover for the video of the investigation.
Ahmed is not alone. And while, the Arakat family is known politically and intellectually in Palestine and abroad, the use of lethal force, the denial of medical care, the degrading treatment of his body, these are patterns in general in Palestine that other Palestinians are faced with. So we used Ahmed's case as an opportunity to talk about broader systemic patterns of violence in Palestine. You know, Ahmed was hit by bullets. He was hit, we know, at least once. He was shot at 6 times. But what we're seeing with Ahmed is a pattern, and it's a pattern that Palestinians are facing, which is what we call a killing through time. Another case that we worked on in Umm al-Hiran showed the same incident where a Palestinian is shot, this is Yaqub Mustafa Abu Al-Kiyan, and left to bleed without medical attention. And this is the pattern that deserves condemnation and investigation and attention, because it's not just the bullet that kills, it's the denial of medical care.
And what happens after the ambulances leave?
The ambulances leave. And what we see is a series of Israeli units, police, military, forensic units, that take turn in moving his body. His body is moved to his back, so he's laying on his back. They take off his shirt. They put markers around him for the bullets. They take photos of him. They take off his socks and his shoes. They put various tarps on him, a silver tarp, a black tarp. And eventually what we find is that at one point, Ahmed is laying completely naked on the scene. He is fully undressed, head to toe, and he's surrounded by around 20 Israeli officers, 2 military jeeps, a police car. And these officers standing around him are smoking around him. So it's this hyper-militarized environment where this sort of naked body, corpse, is being laid, signifying both inhumane and degrading treatment of the body. And this was extremely disturbing for us. This was really troubling for us. It was the first time where we had come across such a case where someone is fully undressed on the scene by the army. And clearly the scene wasn't covered because a journalist was able to document it. A journalist was able to take a photo of Ahmed's naked body laying there around these Israeli officers. And until eventually another Israeli ambulance arrives and he is taken with that ambulance. And that was the last time when Ahmed's body was seen.
Less than 2 hours after the crash, shortly after 5 p.m., another Israeli ambulance arrives and takes Ahmed. That's the last time he's seen. The Israeli authorities still haven't opened an official investigation into the incident. They're also refusing to release details of Ahmed's autopsy that would show Ahmed's wounds and explain the cause of death. If that information were to be released, how would it change your investigation?
A formal Israeli investigation would involve looking at the remaining security footage, to look at the vehicle's behavior in different angles. It would involve looking at the black box of the vehicle, which would tell us a lot about whether there was a brake, whether the handbrake was up. So it would clarify a lot of blank spots that we have in the investigation, and a lot of significant doubts that we've raised against the army's official claims. It is the onus of the army to prove that their claims are indeed the case. Releasing an autopsy of Ahmed's body would tell us how many bullets hit him. It would tell us whether and what medical care he would have needed in that moment. And if anything, it is the right of the family to know how their son has died, how many bullets hit him, where was he hit, how were his last moments. This is information that is being denied to the family, causing them more trauma and more stress, and is designed essentially to humiliate and to collectively punish Palestinian families.
It's been 8 months since Ahmed was shot dead at the container checkpoint, and his family is still waiting for Israel to release his body. His body is one of dozens that Israeli authorities are withholding, as a punitive measure against Palestinians suspected of carrying out attacks. This practice is also used to give Israel leverage in future negotiations with Palestinians. As a result, grieving families are denied proper burial and closure. This episode was reported, produced, and edited by me, Henriette Shakar. Special thanks to the Arakat family, Forensic Architecture, Natasha Dudinsky, Amjad Iraqi, and Ido Conrad. If you haven't already, subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a minute, leave us a rating. It really helps other people find us.